So we are getting back into it this week. 2 weeks ago on March 18th, H.R. 6201, or the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, was put in place. Now, while I know the message we released on Sunday said that we were going to be talking about this law and the historic stimulus package, we decided that these bills are too important to try to cram together or rush through. And seeing as how the stimulus package is over 850 pages, we decided to take our time with that. So this episode is going to be solely focused on the First Families Act and what it does. If we have enough time to put together a quality episode, we will see you Wednesday with the first episode of our series on the $2 trillion stimulus package. If not, then we will be at you on Saturday. But be sure, this law that we are going to cover today is filled with things that you are going to want to know about. This is
Lessons from the Screen.
Welcome to Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any particular information that you can get from any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. And as always, you are welcome. You are most welcome. You are so welcome. In fact, that you're welcome. Anyways, Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PAX Inc., a black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life of black people in America through education, culture shift, and economics. You can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's PAXinc.org. Go on over there, check out the Learning Center, read a book, leave a comment, tell a friend to tell a friend, tell a friend to check it out, then tell a friend, leave a review, become a member, give a donation, take a survey. Don't forget the Amazon smile. Do whatever you can to help them because they are doing everything that they can to help you. And Amazon smile might not be a good thing right now, but if you're going to order on Amazon in the middle of the coronavirus, why not use smile and go ahead and make a donation? And without further ado, we are going to get right into this show. H.R. 6201, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, has become law, public law, 116-127. So, since the last time we talked about the coronavirus, which was 2 weeks ago, because last week we took a break from corona because people were saying they needed a break from corona, and we talked about the fall of I forget what the name of it was. It was so trash. But anyways, you can go check that episode out. It was a long one, but it was a good one, in my opinion. I don't release the bad ones, so they're all good to me. But since that time, in that last episode, I mentioned two bills, one that had passed and one that was in the process of passing. And I said that I'd talk about the one that was in the process once it passed because I was concerned that there might be a bunch of changes to it. Well, that bill that was in the process has since passed, and another law was also passed. The second law that's passed since then has kind of overtaken this first bill because it is a $2 trillion stimulus package that is historic in size and questionable in impact. But we'll get into that later. Because this week, we're going to be talking specifically about H.R. 6201, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which became Public Law 116-127. Now, I'll repeat what I said earlier, because I know a lot of people were excited and they want to know what's going on with the $2 trillion stimulus package. And here's the deal. That is an 854-page document, and it was signed into law on Friday. Haven't had enough time to process it, and I don't want to rush anything. So I'm not going to rush to process it. I'm going to take my time, but we are going to get it done in a timely fashion with enough time so that people can make plans and understand what they need to do moving forward. So with that being said, the absolute latest that you will get the first episode of that series, and it will be a series, will be on Saturday, this upcoming Saturday, which will be April 4th. All right. So I just wanted to repeat that for the people in the back. Now, H.R. 6201, or the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, was signed into law on March 18th. And we're going to be getting into it. The law itself has 8 sections and a bunch of titles in each one of those sections. So it's you know what? I'm not even going to try to characterize it before I get into it. I'm just going to get into it. So the first title, the first section is for the Department of Agriculture. And really, so the entire first section was basically, for the most part, appropriations bills. It was an appropriations package. And it basically doled out money that can be used by government agencies and departments for the purposes of taking care of the emergency that we're going through as a nation with the whole coronavirus COVID-19 thing happening right now. So the first title of the first section was for the Department of Agriculture, which gets $900 million, $500 million for WIC, $400 million for the Emergency Food Assistance Program, which is under the Commodity Assistance Program banner. And that allows you to get food like right away. Now, this section also allows the Department of Agriculture to approve state plans providing emergency food stamps to families with children who receive free or reduced lunch if their schools were closed due to COVID-19 for at least 5 days. Now, the benefits are clear to be utilized through the EBT system for states. The EBT system is the system they use for food stamps. So for those of you that ain't got food stamps in a while, or have never had food stamps, or are unfamiliar about how they work, you don't actually get the paper checks no more. You actually get a EBT card loaded with money on it, and you swipe it like a credit card. So that same system, these cards, not like a credit card, but it's more like a debit card. But anyways, that same system with these cards will be utilized for the emergency funding or the emergency food distribution resources in the Department of Agriculture. And U.S. territories like the Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, and the Samoa also have these same benefits. Now, the second title is for the Department of Defense, which gets $82 million. Now, that $82 million is for testing and other COVID-19 related services. One of the goals of this is to eliminate copays for those with TRICARE, which is the military's health insurance. And it is very good, if I may say so myself. One of the painful parts of me leaving the military was having to give up TRICARE. Because even though as a vet, I can still get TRICARE through the vet plans, it's nowhere near as good or as cheap. It's nowhere near as cheap as it is when you're actually in the military. And since it's not as cheap, that means it's not as good. So let's just, the facts are facts. It's just not as good. But anyways, Title III is for the Department of Treasury, which gets $15 million to pay for expenses involved with executing this law. Title IV is for the Department of Health and Human Services, and it provides $64 million for testing Native Americans at no cost to the people. Title V is also for the Department of Health, and it gets $1.25 billion, $250 million of which is for the nutrition programs for elderly people living in community living locations, and provides some support for other elderly nutrition programs. And then it also provides $1 billion to reimburse the cost of providing health care related to COVID-19 to people without health insurance. Now, Title VI is for the VA. It provides $60 million to pay for VA testing and COVID-related expenses. Title VII is general provisions, and it requires all agencies receiving funds to provide a report detailing the anticipated uses of funding to the Appropriations Committee within 30 days of the passage of this law, which will be roughly around April 16th, 17th, somewhere around there. It also requires that state and local governments that receive funding provide regular and real-time reporting to state emergency operations centers and the CDC. And it ensures that the money in the law is only available for this fiscal year. And it expresses that emergency funds designated as such are at the discretion of the president in terms of distribution, and that funds transferred for the items in this law retain emergency status. Now, all of the appropriations things and a lot of the changes made here with regards to state policy and state agencies, the states have to opt in. They are not automatically opted in. So, you know, you could have states that choose to make use of this funding and request it and apply for various other waivers and things that are involved in this law, this package. And you could have states that could not. So that's something where you're going to have to be involved on the local level to understand what your state is doing, if they're going to take advantage of these resources, and how they're going to utilize the resources once they get them. So the second section of this law covers nutrition waivers, and it also has a few titles. Now, Title One covers the waivers in general, and it's called Maintaining Essential Access to Lunch for Students Act. And it allows waivers at the request of the state for various meal programs. And Title Two is the COVID-19 Child Nutrition Response Act. And this authorizes the Department of Agriculture to issue waivers for child nutrition programs are for child nutrition program requirements to states under the National School Lunch Program, and it grants waivers to allow meals to be delivered to children without grouping them together for the meals. It also grants waivers to the nutritional content served to the children if it is determined that the waiver is necessary to provide meals and snacks due to supply chain disruptions, or if the secretary determines it to be necessary. So basically, they can give meals to people, to kids, without having them all be in a large group in a room. And if necessary, they don't have to be concerned with the nutritional content of the food served. They can give the kids anything as long as they're giving them something. And that's only if they wouldn't be able to give the kids anything because of the nutritional requirements. But I'm going to be honest, that right there still gave me some pause. I understand why it was done that way, but I also understand the way things tend to go down here in this country. And that makes me a little bit nervous to being able to waive the nutritional requirements for meals served to people that need these meals, people that are impoverished or underprivileged or whatever the case might be. If they're getting these meals because they can't provide meals of their own, then they should be able to get the same quality in terms of nutritional content as they would elsewise. I don't know that I like waiving the nutritional requirements. What I think would have been better is if they had a set aside or provided additional funding, or just maybe even thought a little bit longer, because all of these bills have been rushed through very quickly as these politicians attempt to just do something. But if they had a thought a little bit longer about how they could maybe shore up the supply chain, shore up distribution, maybe make use of surplus stocks that are already in place, agricultural supplies that are already in place, I think there are other ways that they could have done this. And then if need be, they could have provided this waiver after the fact when necessary, instead of providing it, you know, as this preemptive measure. That's not to say I'm not against preemptive measures, but I think they have to make sense, and they can't be preemptive measures that have the possibility of being abused. And in my opinion, this is a preemptive measure that has the possibility of being abused, especially considering that this next part, I'll go ahead and get into that. It also provides a waiver that allows WIC to cert or recert without being physically present, or to deter certain testing requirements used to determine nutritional risk. Anybody receiving a waiver is required to give a report within 1 year of receiving the waiver to the Secretary of Agriculture that details the use and the impact of the waiver. Now, that second part, providing a report within a year of receiving the waiver, that means you get the waiver first, and then you tell them what you did or why you needed it. Now, I know there are going to be structures in place to provide for applications and things like that, and there will be some checks in place, but the way this thing is worded, in my opinion, it makes it so that malicious actors could cut the nutritional content provided in these meals for whatever reason, cost saving reasons, less stress reasons, for whatever reason, maybe even racist reasons or other issues of superiority or social concepts of people that don't need to exist. For whatever the reason, you could get this waiver, shortchange people on nutritional content, and then have a year to make up some bullshit ass excuse about why you got it. Excuse my language, but let's just be real. Why did I say excuse my language? If you've been listening to this show, you know that I curse. Anyways, so I do take, like, that for me is a pause. It's a moment of concern where I do feel like Okay, we should have thought about this a little bit more. Now, Title III is on SNAP waivers. SNAP is the food stamp program. And this section suspends work requirements from the food stamp program during the crisis and provides emergency food stamps during the emergency declaration. So those people that have been removed from food stamps for work-related issues, work-related reasons, now you can get back on the program and be reinstated. It also allows states to provide emergency allotments to households on food stamps that can't be more than the maximum monthly allotment for family size, but these requests must be backed by data. So this, in my opinion, is kind of what they should have did when it came to the child nutrition program and had those requests also backed by data. But that wasn't in the verbiage, at least not from my understanding of the verbiage. It also gives the Department of Agriculture the ability to adjust administrative requirements according to what is happening in the area. Now, I do like the idea that local officials have the ability to make adjustments as necessary. I think that's going to be one of the key components to making sure that the entire nation is taken care of, is understanding that we are a federation of states that works under this joint agreement that is the United States. And so in that, every state has its own culture, its own structure, its own policy, and every state has a different population and different needs. And so I like the idea that the federal government has in this scenario of allowing the states to dictate what they need. What is troubling, and I have to say this, and this is why I went on the mini rant about the child nutritional waivers, is that historically speaking, states have not had the best interest of Black people in mind. Even when when you go back to the whole Civil War concept with people talking about states' rights versus federal rights, federal law, and people talking about slavery versus this and that. And look, it's really all the same argument. The states wanted slavery. That was states' rights. So, and if you look throughout history, most of the times when states were given control of a resource, especially southern states, and told to dole this resource out to the population, minorities and Blacks in particular, because I'm Black and that's who I'm talking to, because I know our story and our situation, have gotten the shitty end of the stick. So I like the idea of states being able to dictate what's proper for their populations, but I don't like the track record that states have for taking care of non-dominant populations. And that's just, there's no other way to say that. Now, Section 3 covers emergency family and medical leave expansion and is labeled as such with ACT on the end. And the first part of this section gives employees the right to take public health emergency leave through December 31st, 2020, to care for a child with COVID-19. Employers with less than 500 workers must provide up to 12 weeks paid leave under these circumstances. Employers are not required to pay for the first 10 days, but an employee can use accrued paid leave during this 10-day window. Now, after the 10-day window, employers must at least pay 2/3 of an employee's regular pay for the number of hours worked per week in a normal work week. And the maximum amount of compensation is $200 per day and $10,000 per year. Now, employers are also required to restore the employee's former position if they use public health emergency leave, unless the employer has less than 25 workers and has made reasonable efforts to retain the position, but the position no longer exists due to the Rona. So are two conditions caused by the Rona, or the public health emergency. And I'm gonna be honest. Reasonable efforts is way too vague, in my opinion. It offers way too much space for employers to fire people, reduce their staff, and blame it on the corona. And if given enough time, and they will have enough time, they can make it out to be something that was caused by the corona. Now, I understand why this is in here, but I don't think it should have been put in here this way, in my opinion. We know corporations are going to, you know, like, I've been in corporate boardrooms. They don't even speak about their employees as employees. They speak about them in terms of man hours. It is real easy to just get to talking about terms of cost savings from payroll reductions due to a reduction in man hours and just make it look like those man hours were reduced because of COVID-19 related problems, challenges, and then dismiss staff that way in order to save cost or in order to allow a company to get adjusted to a new normal, which is essentially what happened after the 2008-2009 crisis, or that whole housing bubble thing when that crashed, and there was a jobless recovery where companies, just employees, got used to doing more for the same amount of wages, and companies' profits rebounded without expanding the workforce. I see this as being another opportunity for something like that to happen. I get the excusing of companies that employ less than 25 workers. I get that. That makes total sense. If you're a small business, you might not necessarily have the ability to funds the any of the things that you might need to retain a position going through what we're going through right now. But for these companies, these large corporations, these with hundreds or even, you know, especially thousands of employees, they have the headroom. So I don't like this being here. Now, there can be a waiver or something later, you know, that is issued. I feel like a lot of this stuff that they're doing beforehand should be done after the fact. Our companies, our people, our situations should have to arise and allow states or corporations to apply for exemptions instead of giving them the exemption and then giving them the ability to clear up why they did what they did after the fact. I just don't like how that works out. Anyways, moving forward. Now, the Department of Labor may, with good cause, exclude certain health care providers, including emergency responders, from public health emergency leave eligibility and exempt employers with less than 50 employees if the requirements would place that business at risk. And that, again, is another one of those things where it's kind of just like what I was talking about. It also stipulates that employers subject to multi-employer bargaining agreements, you know, so employers that are dealing with unions. My mind went blank for a second. Companies that are dealing with unions, essentially, they can contribute to a multi-employer fund to fulfill their obligations, and employees can get compensation from that fund for leave or any other situation that they're having related to work reduction in COVID-19. Now, employers with fewer than 50 employees during the last 20 work weeks of last year aren't liable for not providing for the things listed in this section. And again, healthcare providers and emergency responders can exclude employees. This division is supposed to take effect. This section is supposed to take effect within 15 days of enactment, which would be April 2nd. Now, I got a big problem with the way we're treating healthcare workers. And you know what? I'm going to save it for the end. Now, Section 4 is labeled the Emergency Unemployment Insurance Stabilization and Access Act of 2020. And it funds emergency grants for fiscal year 2020 for unemployment programs if certain requirements are met by the state. Now, the amount available for each state is based on the proportion of the total taxable wages of each state last year, as determined by the Department of Labor. Now, if a state requires employers to notify employees about unemployment availability at the time of separation, ensures that the application for unemployment are available through at least two of the three methods, in person, by phone, or online, and provides assistance with processing unemployment, then they get 50% of the funds determined to be available to the state. To get the other 50%, they have to have the number of claims increased by 10% or more compared to the same quarter last year, and they have to have demonstrated policies to increase access to unemployment compensation by doing things like waiving the requirement to search for work and the 1 week waiting period. Now, I really like this section in particular because it forces states to get involved in making sure that the people that work in those states are fully aware of these emergency funds and these opportunities and these grants for unemployment programs. If they don't get involved, they don't get the money. And it also has it tiered. So if you do the things that is considered baseline, you get half of the funds that are determined to be available. But if you actually can prove that you need the funds, and if you have taken steps to make accessing unemployment benefits easier for the people, then you get the other half, which would bring you to a total of 100%. That is a great way of incentivizing good and proper actions on the state level by the federal government. I like this as a way of getting things done, especially in the times we live in right now. Now, this section also suspends the interest on federal payments to states for unemployment compensation through December 31st, 2020. Now, the Department of Labor must assist states in informing the public about the availability of short-term compensation and provide technical assistance and guidance. This section also increases the federal share of payments to states for extended and regular unemployment to 100% through December 31st, 2020. Now, the way unemployment works is the state pays some and the federal government pays some. What this does is it basically says the federal government will take on all and will provide you with these grants, provided you do these other things that are necessary. Now, the interesting thing here is that the state's interest rate payments for unemployment compensation are being suspended. Now, the reason that is interesting to me is because states, from my understanding, some states, I'll say that because I'm not sure of how it works in all states, but states have to pay interest on the funds that they get from the federal government to pay unemployment. They recoup the money they pay out plus the interest by taxing corporations. Now, by suspending the interest rate on those payments, I am curious about what states are going to do with corporate income tax, or with corporate unemployment tax. I am curious about whether or not they are going to also slash their corporate income tax requirement as a measure of saving corporations money during this time period, which would essentially be freeing up more money for corporations? Or will they use that to build some sort of surplus funding for other things that need to be done? I am also curious about how that slashing of the that interest rate that the federal government applies to the states and that the states recruit from an unemployment tax on corporations. I am also curious as to how and whether or not that would actually get passed down to the workers some kind of way. So I'm sure these things are cleared up a bit. As a matter of fact, I know these things are cleared up in the $2 trillion stimulus package. But when I first read this section, those were the very first things that popped in my mind. So, something to think about until we get back with that show. Or if you can't wait, you know, go and read the 850 page whatever yourself. Not to say that you shouldn't, because even if we are doing it, you should definitely go and look up the CARES Act and read it yourself. Now, Section 5 focuses on sick leave, and it requires employers to provide paid sick leave to employees who can't work because of COVID-19, with a focus on full-time employees, entitling them to 80 hours of paid sick time with immediate availability if the employee is subject to a quarantine or isolation order, has been advised by healthcare providers to self-quarantine, is caring for an individual who is subject to self-quarantine, or who is caring for a child because the child's school or care provider is closed, or who is experiencing a substantially similar circumstance related to COVID-19 as specified by the Department of Health and Human Services with the Department of Labor. Now, sick time under this section can be used before other paid leave that may be available, and part-time workers are entitled to paid sick time for the average number of hours worked during an average two-week period, and this paid sick time does not carry over. Employers must provide clear notice in the workplace of the emergency sick time requirements in this section, and labor has to provide publicly available models of acceptable notices no later than 7 days after the enactment, which they did on the sixth day, which was March 24th. Now, employers also can't take negative actions against workers who take leave under this section or attempt to enforce the requirements of this section. If they do, they are subject to fines and imprisonment under the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, which is basically a fine of no more than $10,000 or imprisonment of no longer than 6 months. Yes, I know that needs to be drastically updated, because in 1938, $10,000 was a shitload of money. In 2020, it is not. Not if you're talking about a major corporation. Anyways, employers are not required to pay for unused emergency paid sick time if an employee resigns, retires, or is fired. They use the cute word, is terminated. You got fired. And emergency sick time takes effect within 15 days of this law and expires on December 31st, 2020. Employers with fewer than 500 employees and government agencies are subject to this section. Employers are required to pay the regular salary up to $511 a day and $5,110 in aggregate for paid sick time for personal use, and $200 a day and $2,000 aggregate in paid sick time used to care for a child or other impacted persons. Now, with good cause, labor may exclude certain healthcare providers and emergency responders from eligibility and exempt employers with less than 50 employees if this section will put the business at risk. Now, once again, I have a lot to say about the whole healthcare angle, but I'm going to save it for the end. Very sad by thy side. Praise thy name, praise thy name. So section 6 covers health provisions, and it requires private health insurance coverage of COVID-19 testing without cost sharing. No co-pays, no none of that other foolishness. It also requires Medicare to cover visits to healthcare providers for COVID-19 matters without cost sharing. The same for Medicare Advantage, the same for Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, the same for state Medicaid programs that cover uninsured individuals, TRICARE, Native Americans, including Alaskans. And this law also extends liability protection to manufacturers, distributors, prescribers, and users of approved respiratory devices that are subject to specified emergency use authorizations and used during the period of January 27th, 2020 to October 1st, 2024. This works in tandem with the emergency authorization that allows for the use of unapproved drugs, biological products, or devices, or for the unapproved use of such products to respond to a declared emergency. It also adds $2.7 million to the Virgin Islands, $3.8 million to Guam, $3.1 million to the Northern Mariana Islands, $2.3 million to the American Samoa, and $100 million to Puerto Rico for Medicaid allotments to use in these U.S. territories in order to provide free COVID-19 testing. Now, I got a small issue with the emergency declaration's power to grant pharmaceutical industries and medical device manufacturers and other people in the healthcare sector to begin to create things and perform tests at an accelerated rate that bypasses the restrictions that are in place. The restrictions that are in place already don't totally prevent abuses and malpractice and various other nefarious and malicious things from happening. In a time where we are in an emergency health declaration, I understand the need to speed up the process, but I don't like the idea that the safety is compromised in order to speed up the process. I don't like the ideas that corporations cannot be held liable for doing things in the name of speeding up the process. And that is always going to be something that troubles me. I know it's a fine line you got to walk on, but I do not like this policy of during national health emergencies, suspending the rules that were put in place to protect the American people. I just don't like it. And I'm sure if we all sat down and put our heads together, we could come up with a way to both speed up the process and maintain the safety of the people. And that might simply be involved in being more forward thinking and being focused more on preventative maintenance instead of trying to react to a situation. Now, I understand you can't predict every situation, but let's be fucking clear. This situation could have been prevented. It could have at least been better preempted, and it did not have to get this bad. But that is not a conversation for this show. But it is a conversation that will be had, especially once all this shit is passed. So Section 7 covers tax credits, and it gives a credit against payroll taxes for 100% of the employer-paid qualified sick leave wages paid each calendar quarter with limitations. The amount of sick leave wages taken into account for the purposes of a credit can exceed $200 a day for any employee and $511 a day for emergency sick leave, with an aggregate number of days being limited to 10, and no more than $10,000 for all calendar quarters per employee. Now, transfers from the general fund of the Treasury are authorized to cover reductions in revenue resulting in this credit. And this section also allows self-employed workers to claim 100% income tax credit under the Emergency Sick Leave Act. For other employees, it's a 67% credit, income tax credit. Now, self-employed people have to maintain documentation prescribed by the IRS to establish eligibility for the credit. And leave wages are also not considered wages for the purposes of Federal Insurance Contributions Act. And then, you know, we'll just bundle this in. Section 8 simply exempts this law from PAYGO 2010, which required that new legislation that affects revenues and spending on entitlement programs does not increase the projected budget deficits. So that was the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And I'm going to be clear here. One of the reasons I have my issues with this thing, and I do think largely it's beneficial for workers, I also think largely it's beneficial for employers, but the issue I have here is they just gotta, you know, we just had the tax reform that gave a lot of these companies huge permanent tax breaks, and the, you know, the rest of us, our tax breaks were temporary. And I'm not even going to get into that because that isn't what this is about. But what I am seeing here is another tax break for corporations. And that concerns me. That's why I was making the statements I was making about being concerned about certain things that I was concerned about. Revenues are going to take a hit. The government, state level, local level, and federal level are going to take a hit. And when they take a hit, the programs, the social programs, and the things of that nature that they fund take a hit. So, indirectly speaking, every tax break given to a corporation or a wealthy millionaire or whatever the case might be is a strike against social programs and the people that depend on them. And that's the balancing act that the American government has to strike. And of late, it has been siding in or weighing in heavily on the side of the wealthy and the corporations, which means that it is directly and indirectly punching impoverished people and people without resources in the face. So even as they are ramping up coverage and ramping up the idea of the food stamp program, the administration is still in court trying to get people kicked off the food stamp program and trying to get people kicked off social welfare programs in general so that they can brag about all of these people getting off welfare without stating that they didn't get off because they were able to get off. They got off because they were kicked off. And I see a lot of the same things potentially happening with the way that this thing was worded. Now, I understand they had to do something and they did something. I'm just questioning what the things they did, the impact of the things that have been done regarding this bill, and how far those things are really going to travel down when it comes to affecting the average American person, especially when you consider that COVID-19 is infected well over 130,000 people at the time of this show being recorded. And it's probably going to get exponentially higher than that. And people are sick for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks. And there are a lot of stipulations in here that says that emergency pay leave will only be taken care of for 10 days and things of that nature. It doesn't look like it looks like there are going to be some problems here. And I'm just going to say that. Now, the problem I have in general, and we're going to get off this because I talked a little bit about how I felt, and I really just like to give you guys the information. But the problem in general that I have with this thing right now is, and it's not just this bill, but it's all of the bills with regards to healthcare workers. Healthcare workers do not need to be excluded from any of the waivers or any of the benefits of being an employee in America. They need to be able to take emergency paid leave. They need to be able to take leave, period. They need to be able to be tested when they've been exposed. They need to be told, you know, and just recently an article came out in New York where one of the chief administrators for the healthcare system there in New York said that the only way healthcare employees should not be coming into work is if they are about to be admitted into the hospital for COVID-19. I have read hospital policies and healthcare policies from officials here in North Carolina and from people in other states that have essentially said that if you're exposed to COVID-19, we will not test you and you will continue to come to work until you start showing symptoms. And this is even after the fact of knowing that you can spread this particular disease before you start showing symptoms. An asymptomatic person can still spread COVID-19. And so why are we making it a scenario where the people that are needed to fight this disease are placed on the front lines and given such poor protection in terms of policy, and they've already had their personal protective equipment and their safety garments restricted because of panic purchasing and silliness on the part of the population? What happens when these people start getting sick? Or when hospitals start becoming the den of contamination, where now people aren't going to hospitals because they are more likely to get sick in the hospital than they are to get treated and get well in the hospital because so much of the staff have been infected with COVID-19 and are still being forced to work because they can't take paid leave because laws like this one are saying that they are excluded from the benefits and the necessity of protections that are provided by these laws. It doesn't make sense to me that we would do these sorts of things to our healthcare workers. It just doesn't compute that we would turn our hospitals into basically contamination zones. And then tell people to go into these zones to work to treat people. And then let these people come home to their families to contaminate their own families. When healthcare workers start to become the center of spread, the center of contagious activities, when we're no longer considering whether or not you traveled to China, but we're considering whether or not you have had contact with a healthcare worker, we're going to look back at these laws and ask ourselves, what the hell were we thinking? That is a major concern I have with a lot of what's going on with regards to this COVID-19 foolishness. And I'm not calling the actual disease foolishness, But I am saying that a lot of these policies put in place that exclude healthcare workers and exclude healthcare providers and exclude people that provide health services are wrongheaded and ignorant to the facts. Especially if we need these people to be healthy. You can have 1 million beds, but if you only have a staff of about 15,000, what good are those 1 million hospital beds? If you have 100,000 intensive unit beds, but you only have a staff of 10,000 people, what good is the 15,000? What good is the 5,000 that's left? So I have a huge issue with this. And this is just based on my understanding of this, what I've read, and my understanding of the policies that I've read. But it seems like healthcare workers who are needed in order to protect and slow this pandemic down are being put in harm's way and are not being offered any sort of policy protections. Now, I understand we're scared that if we give them these protections, they might all call out. But they should have the opportunity to take care of themselves if they need to take care of themselves and to take care of their families, if they need to take care of their families without it compromising their ability to provide for themselves and their families, the same way everybody else has that right. It seems like we're putting more faith in corporations than in the people that work at them. And that is wrong to me. That doesn't make sense to me. But outside of that, I don't have too much of a problem with it than the other things that I mentioned. So let me know what you think in the comments. Let me know how you feel about this thing and where it's going and how it's going. Let me know if you agree with me, you disagree with me, if I missed something that you think is significant, or if I missed something that you think is wrong. In my own analysis and my own reviewing of this thing. Like I said, on Wednesday we will try to come back with another show, but if I can't give you a quality product, I'm not going to, and I'll see you on Saturday. And this has been another episode of
Lessons from the Screen. What we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review. So you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
I want to thank you guys once again for listening to Lessons from the Screen. I want to ask you guys to go to, if you have an Android device, go to the Google Play Store, type in Freedom Train Radio. You'll see the logo of the train. Download the app, get the app. It'll keep you up to date on all of the shows and everything else that's going on here at the Freedom Train Network. Also, head on over to www.freedomtrainradio.com and check out all the shows. Leave comments, leave reviews. If you want to reach us or say anything to us, that's the best way to do it. Because if you just reach out through your social media, your a podcast listening app or YouTube or whatever, we don't check all of those things, but we do check the website. So go there. Also, I just want to thank you guys once again for tuning in, and see you next week. Let me know what you think about the show you just listened to. Let me know if you agree, disagree, you felt like I missed something, whatever it is, just holla at your boy, and I will see you next week or whenever the next show comes out. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show again, hit us up on the Freedom Train Radio website and let us know that you're interested in sponsoring a particular show or the entire network.